Chapter 5. The Western Three Seas. A quote from Canticles, 18:9. The Chronicle of the Tusk. As death is the sum of all harms, so murder is the sum of all sins. A quote from Asensius, the Limping Pilgrim. The world has its own ways, sockets so deep that not even the gods can dislodge them. No urn is so cracked as fate. Late Spring, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk. Somewhere south of Gilgath. That which comes after determines what comes before in this world. The gift of Yatwer walked across ordained ground. His skin did not burn, thanks to the swarthiness he had purchased with his seed. His feet did not blister, thanks to the calluses he had purchased in his youth. But he grew weary as other men grew weary, for like them, he was a thing of flesh and blood. But he always tired when he should grow tired, and as every slumber delivered him to the perfect instant of waking, once to the sound of lutes, and to the generosity of travelling mummers, another time to a fox that bolted, leaving the goose it had been laboriously dragging. Indeed, his every breath was a gift. He crossed the exhausted plantations of Anserka, drawing stares from those slaves who saw him. Though he walked alone, he followed a file of thousands across the fields, for he was always the stranger he pursued, and the back before him was forever his own. He would look up, see himself walking beneath a solitary, wind-swept tree, vanishing stride by stride over the far side of a hill. And when he turned, he would see that same tree behind him, and the same man descending the same slope. A queue of millions connected him to himself, from the gift who coupled with the holy crone, to the gift who watched the Aspect Emperor dying in blood and expressionless disbelief. He was the ripple across dark waters, a bow of force thrown across a length of a child's rope. He saw the assassin gagging on his own blood. He saw the besieging armies, the hunger in the streets. He saw the holy shrier turn oblivious and bare his throat. He saw the Endymion Heights crashing upon itself, the Empress's eyes flutter about her final breath. And he walked alone, following a road of fields, stranded in the now of a mortal soul. Day after day, across mile after mile of tilled earth, the very bosom of his dread mother. He slept beneath the rising stalks, the nascent heads, listening to his mother's soothing whisper, staring at stars that were silver lines. He followed his footprints across the dust, witnessing more than plotting the murder of the dead. The River Sempis. At least, Malawabe thought to himself as he swayed in his saddle, he could say he'd seen a ziggurat before he died. What could that fool Lakaro say? There was more to travel than bedding Nilnameshi slave boys, just as there was more to diplomacy than wearing an ambassador's wig. Cohorts of horsemen fanned across the land, filing along irrigation dikes, filtering through groves and across millet fields. Hills like broken molars fenced the north, marking the arid frontier of Gedea. The River Sempis lay to the immediate south, black and green and placid, broad enough to shroud the south bank in blue-gray haze. Five plumes of smoke rose from disparate points on the horizon before them. One of those plumes, Malawabe knew, led the dusky army to Iathea. "It's a dangerous thing," Fanile Ab Kaskamandri said from his side, a sharp grin drawing wide his elaborate goatee, "to parley with the enemies of dangerous men. And in the whole wide world, my friend, no man is so dangerous as Cursifra." Despite the Paddy Raja's smile, something shrewd and quite humorless glinted in his eyes. Second negotiant Malawabi, emissary of the High Holy Zayim, matched the man's gaze, careful to conceal his frown.
Cruciffa, he repeated.
Ah, you mean the Aspect Emperor.
The Bamayu sorcerer was old enough to remember the days when Kayan ruled the Eastern Three Seas. Of all the outland peculiarities to leak into Zayim, few proved more vexing than the Fenim missionaries who trickled across the frontier, bearing their absurd message of fear and damnation. The god was solitary. The gods were in fact devils, and all their ancestors had been damned for worshipping them, all of them. You would think that claims so preposterous and repulsive would require no rebuttal, but the very opposite had been the case. Even the Zayumi, it turned out, were quick to embrace tales of their own iniquity, so universal is self-loathing among men. Not a month passed, it sometimes seemed, without some public flaying. Even still, when Fanile's Padiraja father had sent an embassy to attend the coronation of Malawabi's cousin, Ngonkakal, the Kayanine grandees had caused a sensation among the Kajaneta. High Holy Zayum had always been an inward nation, too distant and too vain to concern itself with events or peoples beyond its sacred frontier. But the Kayanine's pale skin, the stark luxury of their dress, their pious reserve, everything about them had hummed with exotic allure. Overnight, it seemed, the Zayumi fondness for elaborate image and ornamentation had become dowdy and obsolete. Many caste nobles even began cultivating goatees, until, that is, his cousin reinstated the ancient grooming laws. Malawabi could scarce imagine these Kayanine inspiring an upheaval in fashion, where the grandees of Kaz Commandry's embassy possessed the dress and bearing of heroes. Fanile's men were little more than desert bandits. He had expected to ride with the likes of Scalrus or King Genjahoy, men terrible in war and gracious in peace, not a ragtag army of horse thieves and rapists. Fanile alone reminded him of those ambassadors from long ago. He wore a helm of shining gold, five spikes rising from the peak, and perhaps the finest coat of mail Malawabi had ever seen. A mesh of inhuman manufacture, he eventually decided. His yellow silk sleeves hung like pennants from his wrists. His curved sword was obviously a famed heirloom. The instant he had noticed it, Malawabi had known he would say, "That glorious blade, that was your father's." He even knew the solemn way he would pitch his voice. It was an old diplomat's trick, making a conversational inventory of the items his counterparts wore. Relationships went much smoother, Malawabi had learned, in the absence of verbal holes. "Cruciffra," the Padiraja repeated with a curious smile, as if considering the way the name might sound to an outsider. "The light that blinds." Fanile Ab Kazgamandri was nothing if not impressive. Handsome in the hard way of desert breeding, his falcon eyes set close about a hooked nose, arrogant to the point of being impervious to insult and slight, and being quite agreeable as a result. The bandit Padiraja he might be, but he was no bandit at least.
"You said no man is so dangerous," Malawabi pressed, genuinely curious. "Is this what you think? That the Anasarimba is a man?" Fanile laughed. "The Empress is a woman, I know that much. I once spared a shrile priest for claiming that he bedded her when she was a whore. The Aspect Emperor? I know only that he can be killed."
"And how do you know this?"
"Because I am the one doomed to kill him." Malawabi shook his head in wonder. How the world revolved about the Aspect Emperor. How many times had he poured himself some unwatered wine just to drink and marvel at the simple fact of the man? A refugee wanders into the Nansurium from the wilderness, with a Skilvendi savage no less, and within 20 years he not only commands the obedience of the entire Three Seas, but its worship as well. It was mad. Too mad for mere history, which was, as far as Malawabi could tell, every bit as mean and stupid as the men who made it.
There was nothing mean or stupid about Anassarimber Kellis. "This is how men reason in the Three Seas?" he asked. He repented the words even as he spoke them. Malawabe was second negotiant for no small reason. He was forever asking blunt questions, forever alienating instead of flattering. He had more teeth than tongue, as the menials would say. But the bandit Padaraja showed no outward sign of offense. "Only those who have seen their doom, Malawabe. Only those who have seen their doom." Fanayo, the Bemayu sorcerer noted with no small relief, was a man who relished insolent questions. "I notice you ride without bodyguards," he ventured. "Why should that concern you?" Though horsemen clotted the fields and berms about them, he and the Padaraja rode quite alone, aside from a cowled figure who trailed them by two lengths. Malawabe had assumed the man was a bodyguard of some description, but twice now he had glimpsed, or thought he had glimpsed, something resembling a black tongue within the cowl's dun shadows. Even still, it was remarkable, really, that someone like Fanayo would treat anyone face to face, let alone an outland sorcerer. Just the previous week the Empress had offered another 10,000 gold kelics for the bandit Padaraja's head. Perhaps it spoke to the man's desperation. "Because," the Bemayu sorcerer said with a shrug, "your insurrection would not survive your loss. We would be fools to provoke the Aspect Emperor on the promise of a martyr." Fanayo managed to rescue his grin before it entirely faltered. He understood the power of belief, Malawabe realized, and the corresponding need to project confidence, both fatuous and unrelenting. "You need not worry." "Why?" "Because I cannot die." Malawabe was beginning to like the man, but in a way that cemented rather than softened his skepticism of him. The second negotiant always had a weakness for vainglorious fools, even as a child. But unlike the first negotiant, Lacaro, he never let his sympathies make his decisions for him. Commitments required trust, and trust required demonstrations. The Sadakan had sent him to assess Fanal Ab Kaskamandri, not to parley with him. For all his failings, Ngonkakol was no fool. With the great ordeal crawling into the northern wastes, the question was whether the new empire could survive the absence of its Aspect Emperor and his most fanatical followers. As the first real threat to the Zayumi people and nation since near antiquity, it needed to fail, and decisively. But wishing ill and doing actual harm were far different beasts. Care had to be taken, extreme care. High Holy Zayum could ill afford any long throws of the number sticks, not after Ngonkakol had so foolishly yielded his own son as a hostage. Malawabe had always been fond of Zaronga, had always seen in him the makings of a truly great Satakan. He needed some real assurance that this desert outlaw and his army of thieves could succeed before recommending the monies and arms they so desperately needed. To take isolated fortresses was one thing, but to assail a garrisoned city? That was quite another. Iathea, the ancient capital of old Dynasty Shigik. Iathea would be an impressive demonstration, most assuredly. "Kersifa was sent as punishment," Fanal continued. "An unholy angel of retribution. We had grown fat. We had lost faith with the strict ways of our fathers. So the solitary god burned the lard from our limbs, drove us back into the wastes where we were born." He fixed the sorcerer with a gaze that was alarming for its intensity. "I am anointed outlander. I am the one." "But fate has many whims. How can you be sure?" Fanile's laughter revealed the perfect crescent of his teeth. "If I am wrong, I always have Mepa." He turned to the enigmatic rider trailing them. "Hey, Mepa, raise your mask." Malawabe twisted in his saddle to better regard the man. Mepa raised bare hands, pulled back the deep cowl that obscured his face. The mask Fanile referred to was not so much a mask as a kind of blindfold. A band of silver as wide as a child's palm lay about his upper face, as if a too large crown had slipped over his eyes. The sun flashed across its circuit, gleamed across the innumerable lines etched into it, water rushing sideways, around and around in an infinite cataract. His cowl thrown back, Meppa raised the band from his head. His hair was as white as the peaks of the Encondrus, his skin nut brown. No eyes glinted from the shadow of his sockets. Malawabi fairly gasped aloud. Suddenly it seemed absurd that he had missed the cue of ochre in the man's dust-rimmed robes, or that he had mistaken the serpent rising from the folds about the man's collar for a black tongue. Kishaurim. "Look about you, my friend," Fanile continued, as if this revelation should settle the second negotiant's every misgiving. He gestured to the pillars of smoke bent across the sky before them. "This land simmers with rebellion. All I need to do is ride fast. So long as I ride fast, I outnumber the idolaters everywhere." But the sorcerer could only think, "Kishaurim." Like every other school, the Bamayu had assumed the water-bearers were extinct, and like every other school, they had been happy for it. The tribe of Indira Kishauri was too dangerous to be allowed to live. Small wonder the bandit Padaraja had such a talent for survival. "Then what need do you have of Zayum?" Malawabi asked quickly. He had hoped Fanile would overlook his obvious fluster. But the sly glint in the man's eye confirmed what the second negotiant had already known. Very little escaped the claws of Fanile's acumen. Perhaps he was the first foe worthy of the Aspect Emperor. Perhaps. "Because I am but one," the Padaraja said. "If a second strikes, then a third will join us, and a fourth." He flung out his arms in an expansive gesture, setting alight the innumerable links of his nimal mail. "The new empire, all of it, Malawabi, will collapse into the blood and lies from which it was raised." The Zayumi emissary nodded as though acknowledging the logic, if not the attraction of his argument. But all he could really think was, "Kishaurim." So, the accursed water still flowed. Discord is the way of imperial power. Triamus the Great once described empire as the perpetual absence of peace. "If your nation wars," he wrote, "not at the periodic whim of aggressors, both internal and external, but always, then your people continually imposes its interests upon other peoples, and your nation is no longer a nation, but an empire." War and empire, for the legendary near-antique ruler, were simply the same thing glimpsed from different summits, the only measure of power, and the only surety of glory. In the Hashrut, the Karathusali Agora, famed for the continuous view it afforded of the scarlet spires, the judges publicly lashed a slave they had apprehended for blasphemy. She was lucky, they reasoned, since they could have charged her with sedition, a capital crime, in which case the dogs would already be lapping her blood from the flagstones. For some reason, the unruly temper of the crowds that surrounded them escaped their notice. Perhaps because they were true believers. Or perhaps because the Hashrut Pole, like the thousands of others scattered across the three seas, was so often used for matters of expedited justice. Either way, they were entirely unprepared for the mob's rush. Within a matter of moments, they had been beaten, stripped, and hung from the hanging stone gutters of the Imperial Custom House. Within a watch, a greater part of the city rioted, slaves and caste menials mostly, and the Imperial garrison found itself engaged in pitched battles in the streets. Thousands died over the days following. Nearly an eighth of the city burned to the ground. In Oswenta, Hampe Sompas, a high-ranking imperial apparati, was found in bed with his throat cut. He was but the first of many, very many, assassinations. As the days passed, more and more shrile and imperial functionaries, from the lowest tax farmers to the highest judges and assessors, were murdered, either by their body slaves or by the bands of armed menials that had taken to revenge killings in the streets. There were more riots. Seleucara burned for 7 days. Aeacnissus was only racked for 2, but tens of thousands were killed, so savage were the imperial reprisals. The wife and children of King Nersepoius were removed to Atrempus for safety's sake. Long-running insurrections flared into renewed violence, for there was no shortage of old and sequestered foes eager to take advantage of the general discord. In the southwest, the Fenum, under Fanial Ab Cascamandri, stormed and seized the fortress of Garrigal in the province of Mongilia, and in numbers so alarming that the empress ordered 4 columns rushed to defend Nensiphon, the former capital of the Cyanene Empire. In the east, the wilder Famiri tribes from the steppes below the Araxes Mountains overthrew their imperial administrators and massacred the Zadunyani converts among them, sons of the families that had ruled them from time immemorial. And the Skilvendi raided the Nanser frontier with a daring and viciousness not seen for a generation. Middle-aged veterans were called up. Militias were levied. 12 small battles were fought across lands famous and obscure. Curfews were extended. The Yatwarian temples were closed, and those priestesses who did not flee were imprisoned and interrogated. Plots and conspiracies were uncovered. In more orderly provinces, the executions were celebrated in garish spectacles. Otherwise, they were carried out in secret, and bodies were buried in ditches. The slave laws, which had afforded protections the enslaved had not known since the days of Cannae, were repealed. In a series of emergency sessions, the Greater Congregate passed several laws curtailing Congress according to caste. Speaking at public fountains became punishable by immediate execution. The caste nobility of all nations suddenly found unity in their general terror of their servants and slaves. Suits were dropped, freeing the courts for more pressing prosecutions. Old and honorable enmities were set aside. The Shraya of the 1,000 temples summoned high-ranking cultic priests from across the 3 seas for what would be called the 3rd Pan-Sumni Council, urging them to set aside their parochial worship to recall the god behind the gods. Shrial priests everywhere inveighed on behalf of their prophet and sovereign. Those Zadunyani who had not joined the great ordeal raised their voices to harangue their peers and their lessers. Groups of them took to murdering in the dark of night those they deemed unfaithful. Sons and husbands simply vanished. And though the new empire tottered, it did not fall. Momen. Anisarimber Kelmomus sat where he always sat when attending the imperial synod, in the prince's box, on a bench cushioned with plush red leather. The same place his older siblings had sat when they were young. Even Theli, before she had joined Mother beneath the circumfix throne. "Recall who it is you address, Pansella," Mother called down in a tight voice. Though positioned relatively low on the palace heights, the chamber, the Synodine, was one of the more luxurious ones in the palace, and certainly among the most curious. Unlike other council chambers, it possessed no gallery for visiting observers, and absolutely no windows. Where airy grandeur was the rule elsewhere, the chamber was long and narrow, with elaborately paneled boxes, the prince's box one of them, lining the short walls, and with steep benches stepping the entire length of the long walls, as if an amphitheatre had been straightened, and then snapped in half, forcing the audience to confront itself. To accommodate the circumfixed throne, a deep marble recess shelved the steep slope to Kelmomus's left, blue-white stone trimmed with bands of black diorite. A scale replica of the circumfix, as it had hung in Karaskand, including his father, hanging spread-eagled and upside-down, rose in sinuous gold from the throne's back. His mother's chair in Thales had been cut into the marble tier immediately below it, their simple design concentrating the glory of the throne above. Some 30 identical seats had been set into the steps rising opposite, one for each of the great factions, whose interests governed the new empire. The floor lay well below all the seats, forcing those who walked it to continually crane their heads up and around to meet the gaze of their interlocutors. It was a narrow strip of bare floor, no bigger than several prison cells set end to end. Kelmomus had heard several functionaries refer to it, and with no little dread, as the slot. Because the man who now paced its length was so fat, Cutius Pansella, the Nancer consul, it looked even more narrow than usual. He had been strutting back and forth for several moments now, long enough for dark stains to bloom from his armpits. "But I must dare speak it," he cried, his shaved jowls trembling. "The people are saying that the Hundred are against us." The Imperial Synod, his mother had told Kelmomus, was a kind of boiled-down version of the Greater Congregate, what other kings in other lands often called a Privy Council, the place where representatives of the new empire's most important interests could confer with their divine ruler. Of course, he always pretended to forget this explanation when he spoke to his mother, and to always whine as he accompanied her to the sessions. But he secretly adored the Synod, and the games within games it invariably revealed, at least when his father failed to attend them. Elsewhere, the words always seemed to be the same, glory this and glory that, and the lofty tones seemed to drone on and on and on. It was like watching men duel with bars of iron. But in the Synodine, both the words and the voices were honed to a cutting edge. Real disputes instead of pantomime, real consequences instead of heavenly petitions. Lives, sometimes in the thousands, were decided in this place as in no other. The young Prince Imperial could almost smell the smoke and blood. This was where real cities were burned, not ones carved of balsa. "Ask yourself," Mother cried to the assembled men, "who will you be when the scripture of these days is written? The craven? The weak-kneed doubter? All of you, as the trial deepens, as the trial always deepens, all of you will be judged. So stop thinking of me as his weaker vessel." Kelmomus jammed his mouth into his forearms to conceal his smile. Though his mother angered often, she only rarely expressed it as anger. The boy wondered whether the fat consul below understood the peril of his situation. He certainly hoped not. "Holy Empress, please!" Pansella exclaimed. This talk, it does not answer our fears. At the very least, you must give us something to tell the people." The Prince Imperial sensed the power in these words, even though he did not fully understand their import. He certainly could see the indecision in Mother's eyes, the realization she had erred. "That one," the secret voice whispered. "Pansella?" "Yes. His breathing offends me." Ever keen to exploit weakness, the round-bellied consul pressed his advantage. "All we ask, most holy empress, is for the tools to work your will." Mother glared at him for a moment, then glanced nervously across the assembly. She seemed to flinch from the gravity of their regard. At last she waved a loose-wristed hand in weariness and capitulation. "Read the sagas," she began without breath. She paused to firm her voice. "Read the sagas, the history of the first apocalypse, and ask yourself, where are the gods? How can the Hundred allow this?" And the little boy could see the craft behind his mother's manner and words. Silence had seized the Imperial Synod. Such was the force of her question. "Theli," his mother said, gesturing to her daughter, who sat gowned in absurd intricacy at her side. Dreadfully thin, she looked like a bird stranded between too many crumbs and the inability to choose.
"Tell them what the mandate schoolmen say."
"The gods are finite," Thalaiapa declared in a voice that contradicted the stark angularity of her frame. "They can only apprehend a finite portion of existence. They fathom the future, certainly, but from a vantage that limits them. The no-god dwells in their blind spots, follows a path they are utterly oblivious to."
She turned, looking from man to man with open curiosity.
"Because he is oblivion."
Mother rested her hand atop Thelly's in a thoughtless gesture of thanks. Behind the panels of his box, the young Prince Imperial fairly cut open his palms for balling his fists.
"She loves me more," he thought. "Yes," the voice agreed. "She loves you more."
The Empress spoke with renewed confidence. "There is a world, my lords. A world concealed. A world of shadow that the gods cannot see." She looked from console to console. "I fear we now walk that world." A wall of bewildered looks greeted her. Even Pansella seemed taken aback. Kel'Momas almost chirped in glee, so proud was he of his mother.
"And the Hundred?"
Old Tutmore, the consul for King Hogra Hogrum of Satadone, croaked, his eyes rimmed with real fear. Alarmed voices clambered in his wake. Their empress graced them all with a sour smile.
"The gods chafe, because like all souls, they call evil what they cannot comprehend."
More astounded silence. Kel'Momas found himself squinting in hilarity. Why anyone should fear the gods was quite beyond him, let alone fools as privileged and powerful as these.
"Because they are old and dying," the secret voice whispered.
Pansella still held the slot. He now stood directly beneath his empress.
"So,"
he said, looking to the others with a strategically blank face.
"So it is true, then. The gods," his gaze wandered, "the almighty gods, are against us."
Disaster. It fairly slapped the blood from Mother's painted face. Her lips retreated, the way they always did during such moments, into a thin line.
"He offends me," the secret voice cooed. "The fat one."
"Now," she began, only to halt to master the emotion in her voice. "Now, Pansella, is the time for care. Heretical superstition will be the end of us all. Now is the time to recall the God of gods and his prophet."
The threat was clear, enough to trigger another exchange of whispers among the tiered men. Smiling with greasy insincerity, Pansella knelt to the floor, so big and so floridly gowned that it looked more like a heap of laundry than a man.
"But of course, Holy Empress."
For the slightest instant, his mother's hatred lay plain on her face.
"Courage, Pansella," she said. "And you too, loyal Tutmore. You must find courage, not in the Hundred, but, as Enri Sejanus and my divine husband have taught, in their sum."
The Nancer consul struggled back to his feet.
"Indeed, Empress," he said, smoothing his silk robes. "Courage, of course." His eyes strayed to the others. "We must remind ourselves that we know better than the gods."
Kel'Momas grappled with the squeal of joy clawing at his throat. He so loved his mother's fury.
"We've never killed someone so fat before."
"Not we, Cataius Pansella. Not you, and certainly not me. Your holy aspect, Emperor. Anassarim Berkelis."
The young Prince Imperial understood what his mother was trying to achieve with these appeals to his father, always using him as a goad, always trying to vanish into the might of his name. But he could also see, with a kind of child cunning,
how this undermined her authority. Once again the obese consul nodded in jowl quivering exaggeration.
Ah, yes, yes. When the cults fail us, we must turn to the thousand temples.
He glanced up as if to say,
How could I be such a fool?
He made a show of turning to Mathenet's vacant seat, then looked to his empress with mock confusion.
But when can we hope to hear our holy shrier's most wise counsel?
Tidings! A voice pealed. Tidings, empress! Most dire tidings! All eyes in the Synodine turned to the figure gasping on the chamber's threshold. Aniothic guardsman, red-faced for exertion.
Most holy empress! The guardsman swallowed against his wind. The Kyanine! The loathsome bandit, Faniel!
What of him? Mother demanded.
He has struck Shygik.
Kel'Momas watched his mother blink in confusion.
But he's marching on Nensophon.
A frantic note climbed into her voice.
Don't you mean Nensophon?
The messenger shook his head in sudden terror. No, most holy empress.
Iothea. Faniel has taken Iothea.
The Endymion Heights was a city in its own right, albeit one enclosed beneath a welter of rooftops, with gilded concourses instead of processional avenues, and maze dormitories instead of alley-riddled slums. Any number of routes could be taken between any two points, allowing the inhabitants to travel in celerity or discretion. Unlike his father, Kel'Momas's mother almost always chose the most discreet route possible, even if it made the journey twice as lengthy. Though some might think this was yet one more sign of her general insecurity, the young boy knew otherwise. Anassarimber Esmenet simply despised the sight of people falling to their faces. The imperial synod dissolved. The empress led her small retinue down into the apertory, before turning to climb the rarely used stairs and halls that threaded the palace's eastward reaches. She clutched Kel'Momas's hand with the too tight desperation he so adored, tugging him when his pace faltered. Thalaipa followed close behind, with Lord Beoxysanchus breathing hard at her side.
"Will Uncle Mathenet get mad at you again?"
Kel'Momas asked.
"Why would you say that?" "Because he blames you for everything that goes wrong. I hate him!"
She ignored him after that, visibly angered.
"Glutton,"
the secret voice reproached.
"You need to take care."
"Most holy empress," Lord Sancus said, into the ensuing silence, "I fear the situation with your brother-in-law grows untenable."
Kel'Momas glanced back at the man. He almost looked like Theli's grandfather. He was so tall and slender, decked in full martial regalia, a ceremonial Kidrahil cuirass, and the purple cloak of a retired general, and clean-shaven in the traditional way. He resembled the old Nanser that Kel'Momas so often saw engraved or painted in the original parts of the palace.
"Faniel is in Shygik," she replied testily. "If you haven't noticed, Sancus, I have more pressing concerns."
But the Patrodomos was not so easily silenced.
"Perhaps if you were to speak with his—"
"No!" the Empress exclaimed, wheeling around to glare up at the man. The wall to their left had yielded to an open colonnade that overlooked the imperial precincts, and the east more generally. The Menenor heaved dark beneath the sun on the horizon beyond. "You must never see my face," she said more evenly. The shadow of an arch divided her from waist to shoulder, so that her lower gown shimmered with light. Kel'Momas pressed his face into the warm, scented fabric. She combed his scalp out of maternal reflex.
"Do you understand, Sancus? Never."
"Forgive me, most holy," the caste noble fairly cried. It was not my intent to cause offense."
He trailed awkwardly, looking as though he had tripped across some disastrous suspicion.
"Most holy empress," he said tightly, "may I ask why the shrier must not see your face?"
Kel'Momas almost chortled aloud,
saved himself by looking away in the appearance of little boy boredom. Over a jumble of roof and structure, he glimpsed a formation of distant guardsmen doing drills on one of the seaward campuses. More soldiers were arriving every day, so many it was becoming impossible for him to adventure in the old way.
"Theli," his mother said from above, "please, would you assure Lord Sancus that I am not a skin spy?"
The patrodomos blanched.
"No, no," he blurted. "That is certainly no—" "Mother is not a skin spy,"
Thaliapa interrupted. His mother's hands and presence slipped away from the boy. Ever conscious of her menial stature, the Empress used the view as an excuse to step clear of the looming patrodomos. She gazed out over the Menenor. "Our dynasty, Sancus, is a complicated one. I say what I say for good reason. I need to know that you have faith enough to trust that."
"Yes, certainly, but—"
"But what, Sancus?"
"Maithenet is the holy Shrya."
Kelmomus watched his mother smile, her calm, winning smile, the one that told everyone present that she could feel what they felt. Her ability to communicate compassion, he had long since realized, was easily her strongest attribute, as well as the one most likely to send him into jealous rages.
"Indeed, Sancus, he is our Shrya. But the fact remains, my divine husband, his brother, decided to trust me with the fate of the Empire. Why might that be, you wonder?"
The man's pained squint relaxed in sudden comprehension.
"Of course, most holy, of course."
Men cast their lots, the Prince Imperial realized. They gambled time, riches, even loved ones, on those great personages they thought would carry the day. Once the gambit was made, you need only give them reasons to congratulate themselves. His mother dismissed both Sancus and Thaliapa shortly afterward. Kelmomus's heart cartwheeled for joy. Again and again and again, he was the one she brought with her to her apartments. He was the one, again and again, the only one. As always, they passed the ponderous bronze door to Enrilatus's room, with their ears pricked. Kelmomus's older brother had ceased screaming of late. Like the seasons, he had his tempests and his idols, leaving the young Prince Imperial with a troubling sense that he was there, his cheek pressed against the far side of the door, listening to their comings and goings. The fact that he had never heard Enrilatus doing this troubled him even more, for he was quite fond of hearing things. Thaliapa once told him that of all his brothers and sisters, Enrilatus possessed his father's gifts in the greatest measure, so much so they continually overwhelmed his mortal frame. Though Kelmomus did not begrudge Enrilatus his insanity, he celebrated it, if anything. He did resent his greedy share of father's blood. And so he hated Enrilatus as well. Mother's body slaves rushed from their antechambers to line the hall to either side, kneeling with their faces to the floor. The Empress brushed past them in distaste, pushed open the bronze doors to her apartments herself. Kelmomus never understood why she disdained using people. Father certainly never hesitated, but he adored the way it gave them more time alone. Again and again he got to hug her and to kiss her and to cuddle. Ever since he had murdered Samarmus. Sunlight rafted through the airy interior, setting the white gossamer shears aglow. A sycamore stood dark and full in the light beyond the balconies, close enough to glimpse the limbs forking through the shadows behind the bushing leaves. Sandalwood scented the air. Capering across lavish carpets, the Prince Imperial breathed deep and smiled. He swept his gaze across the frescoes of Invishi, Carathusel, and Nensiphon. Around the corner's fluted edge, he glimpsed the tall silvered mirror in her dressing room. He saw the chest with the toys he pretended to play with when she was preoccupied. Through the propped doors to her sleeping chamber, he saw her great bed gleaming in the murk. This, he thought, as he always thought, this was where he would live forever.